Welcome to AJP Audio for July 2022. I'm Aaron Van Dorn. Today on the podcast, I spoke with Dr. Richard Keefe, professor of psychiatry, psychology, and neurosciences at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Keefe and colleagues looked at an intervention for major depressive disorder that takes the form of a video game and raises some interesting questions about what interventions look like and whether how patients perceive them impacts their effectiveness. Afterwards, I'll speak with the American Journal of Psychiatry Editor-in-Chief, Dr. Ned Kalin, about how investigating depression ties together the July issue of AJP. Dr. Keefe, some patients with major depressive disorder who respond to antidepressant treatments still show cognitive difficulties, for example, trouble with concentration, decision-making, and forgetfulness. While those difficulties often respond favorably to psychological treatments such as cognitive behavioral therapies, access to those therapies can be constrained. Your study looked at a digital intervention that aims to help with those difficulties in the form of a video game. What can you tell us about the intervention and what were your results?
Thanks, Aaron. It's great to talk to you and thanks for inviting me. AKL-T03 is an investigational digital intervention delivered through a video game experience. The treatment presents stimuli and simultaneous motor challenges that have been found to activate the frontoparietal networks of the brain to enhance cognition related to attention and attentional control. Adam Ghazali and his colleagues at UCSF demonstrated the efficacy of this approach in their lab several years ago, and one of their groundbreaking studies was published in Nature in 2013. The video game treatment works by training interference management at an adaptive and personalized degree of difficulty. Interference is created by displaying two tasks that are to be performed in parallel. You know, multitasking, which of course is very relevant for everyday life these days. One of them is a perceptual discrimination task in which the participants must respond to the designated stimulus targets and ignore the stimulus distractor. And the second one is a sensory motor navigation task in which they must continually adjust their location to interact with targets or avoid obstacles present in the course. Essentially, the participant drives a virtual car down a winding road as quickly as possible while reaching out to touch coins that come into view. It's not so easy at first, but you can improve over time, which of course is part of the point of the treatment. The performance on each task is assessed during single and multitasking conditions, and the difference between them, or the cost of performing both tasks, is the interference that the intervention trains to reduce over time. There are adaptive algorithms that are used in a closed loop system that second to second assesses and adapts the level of cognitive challenge for each patient to optimize the treatment at the individual level.
And what were your results?
So the results were that this type of multitasking test done repeatedly over time actually improves cognitive performance in people who have major depression. And that improvement was compared to a control condition of doing some word games.
What does the medium of video games, which is an inherently interactive medium, offer the treatment? Could the intervention be done with another medium, such as a single-player board game or something else?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, I've never seen any studies that compare video games to single-player board games for cognitive treatment in depression. But the video game interface has some advantage over standard gameplay, like playing board games. First, it facilitates adaptability in an accurate and personalized way with little intervention of a professional. This mode of delivery also allows opportunities to enhance the gameplay by driving user engagement and motivation and personalizing the experience for patients. I think that's really key, is that it's adaptive and personalized. In this particular video game, it was developed based upon neuroscience studies that target specific neural circuits known to be involved in important aspects of cognitive function. And you know, that's not really the goal of most video games, but in this science-based video games, it was, which I think really lends some scientific neuroscience credence to the intervention.
Both the intervention and the control were presented as video games, as you said. One was more of a word or letter style game, but interestingly, your paper indicates the investigatory intervention looked more like a video game than the control. What can you tell us about the two interventions? How did they differ, and what impact do you think those differences had?
it's an important feature of the study to compare two interventions that have video game characteristics. A lot of studies just look at the efficacy of one treatment, and so you never know about placebo effects or learning effects on the cognitive outcome measure. Both interventions in this study were video game interfaces, and our expectancy analysis showed that for both of them, participants in the study had a comparable expectation of benefit. I described the AKL-TO3 intervention before. It's delivered through a racing game that displays two tasks that are to be formed in parallel, and it has features that are similar to some commercially available video games. So it looks a lot like a video game. The control condition was more of a classic letter word puzzle game. The participants have to connect letters in a grid on the screen horizontally, vertically, or diagonally to form as many words of at least two letter combinations. You know, you sometimes see people playing these games in books. Points awarded were based on increasing difficulty, measured by number of words formed, length of the words, and difficulty of letter used. Both of the interventions required continued perseverance and daily commitment for approximately 25 minutes. Interestingly, there was an independent user research study done to understand the perceptions of both interventions, and the people interviewed thought that the control intervention may have a more positive impact on their everyday functions, such as work and being a student or the work they did at home.
What were the impact of the interventions? What results did you see from them?
Yeah, so the results were very interesting. The AKL-TO3 improved performance on a variables of attention test. And what that test measured was someone's ability to engage with stimuli over a pretty long period of time. It was a test that sometimes people find kind of boring. So you have to sort of hang in there and you have to maintain your attention over a fairly long period of time, even when things in that test get difficult. So it's a real relevant measure for this study that this type of video game-based cognitive intervention, you know, rather than cause problems as we sometimes see and worry about video games, in this case, a neuroscience-based measure was actually able to improve the type of attentional systems that we really want to have in everybody, really, but in patients struggling with the cognitive impairments associated with depression in particular.
One interesting aspect of your paper is that you mentioned that there are some design issues that could be addressed in further research. Can you tell us a little bit about the design implications from the paper and what might change going forward?
Absolutely. So one of the things that was very interesting about the results was that some of the people with depression found that the particular design elements, this game was called informally Band Together, and that there were people in a band, and that if performance got better, you had more people in your band. If performance got worse, you actually would lose people in your band. And that experience from the standpoint of people who were depressed was not a good one. And so it wind up having, in some cases, a kind of deleterious effect on patients' willingness to participate in the game going forward. So that was a pretty obvious flaw in the current design that the group at Achille, who developed this game, are working on for future iterations.
You mentioned earlier as well that the control intervention, actually, people perceived it as being a more of an intervention than the actual intervention that you were investigating. Do you think that had any impact on people's perception of it, that the idea that it felt more like a medicine or it felt more like a intervention had an impact on the results from the control arm?
It's hard to know, of course, but possibly, right? I think logically it makes sense that if something, you know, feels like it is enjoyable, right, and people like to do it, which is well known that people love to do these word puzzles. You know, I always see people on planes doing them all the time. And so something like that is just a lot easier to participate in. And so they did it more. They did that more frequently than they did the video game, which I think felt a little bit more like work in this case. The fact that the video game intervention was still superior on attention over time, I think is particularly noteworthy, given that people actually preferred, some people preferred playing the word game.
That's a really fascinating result.
Yeah.
The current intervention you're investigating was designed specifically for adults after an earlier similar intervention was designed for children. Did the interventions differ beyond changing the theming to reflect a more adult group? And did the results between the child and adult groups differ significantly?
Yeah, good question. There were some differences. So the previous prototype, AKL-TO1, used the same underlying technology as AKL-TO3, the one that was used in this study. And the previous one has been used in different populations, including ADHD, multiple sclerosis, and also in previous studies in depression. However, some of the feedback that the company Akili received from the participants in those previous studies suggested that adults had a preference for a different user interface feel. So the designer proposed different user interface versions. The study we published in the American Journal this month was the first to test the feasibility of this upgraded user interface theme while maintaining the same underlying cognitive mechanisms of action.
Given that people seem to respond positively to the control arm and seem to think that it was more of a intervention than the actual intervention, do you think that hiding the intervention as a video game is kind of outthinking yourselves? Or is there an opportunity for looking at these interventions more directly? Or is there some positive aspect to hiding the intervention in a way?
Well, I think that in order to engage people in a video game-based cognitive enhancement therapy, it's important that the participants be motivated to continue to do it over time, right? It's like a drug. It's only going to work if you keep taking it. And so what gets somebody to continue to do something like log onto the computer and for 25 minutes do something, especially if they're depressed, right? So either they have to be motivated by the idea that this is going to make them better, or they have to be motivated by the fact that they are interested in doing it because it's enjoyable.
Sure.
So I think either strategy can be effective, right? I don't think companies such as Akili, who are creating video game-based cognitive interventions, they can't create the same experiences, you know, these commercially available games like Fortnite that costs, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to create with a lot of engagement. But what they can do is they can make it fun enough and they can get patients who feel like this is going to help me. And so I'm motivated to do it because it helps me in that way. So I think there's no simple trick to making these interventions perfect, but I think the designers need to combine that, the idea of making things better and making it enjoyable.
Designing a good game and a new game that hasn't been created before, like crosswords or Wordle or something that kind of takes over, is such a unique skill set. And then also trying to do that when it's also having another aspect of improving something like major depressive disorder, such an interesting needle to thread.
It really is. I mean, I support what these companies like Akili are doing because it's hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I've developed a lot of cognitive assessments. I've never developed an intervention. I've tested the intervention, but even just developing a cognitive assessment is really difficult. You just need years of validity, and you need to get things right. Sometimes you have to go back to the drawing board, or you need to modify stuff. And all the while, you know, when this is a digital tool, all the while that's happening in the context of an updated digital world, right? Not only in terms of what software is available and needs to be used to make sure that people can like use it on their computers or their iPads or their phones, but also the level of graphics continues to explode so that things become more and more real. And so, you know, getting someone to engage with a neuroscience-based video game that is inherently going to be a little bit behind the times, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of the way things look, because the validation process will take a few years. It's always a challenge. And so that's why before I was saying that I think people who do this need to have some understanding that this is going to make them better, because I don't think we're close to the time where you can log on and do something that is really, really fun. And it's all being generated by neuroscience-based theories about how you can make your cognition better.
So what's next for your research?
Yeah, thanks a lot. So, you know, most of my work focuses on evaluating the impact of various treatments, including innovative technological interventions like this one and pharmacologic interventions on CNS disorders with associated cognitive impairment. There are several important studies underway in this space, and we expect to see some important advances over the next few years, particularly in schizophrenia, where the severity of cognitive impairment is particularly devastating. Akili, the company that supports these video game-based studies, they're continuing to investigate their interventions in disorders with cognitive deficits. They have some studies in ADHD, autism spectrum disorders, depression, multiple sclerosis, as well as cognitive impairment associated with COVID and post-operative cognitive dysfunction, or POCD.
Dr. Keefe, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Great. Great to be with you, Aaron, and thanks for inviting me.
Up next, Dr. Ned Kalin on the July issue.
Dr. Kalin, welcome back to AJP Audio for July 2022.
Thank you.
Earlier in the episode, I spoke with Dr. Richard Keefe about an interesting digital intervention for major depression, which is a theme that runs through the July issue. What more can you tell us about it?
Yes, Aaron, I'm pleased to be with you again, and I'm also pleased to be able to talk about the July issue, which is devoted to better understanding and assessing new treatments for depression. The paper relevant to digital interventions is really quite interesting, authored by Keefe and his colleagues. In this study, I'm sure as Dr. Keefe discussed, the aim was to basically use a digital intervention to try to see if it could be targeted at some of the cognitive symptoms that are commonly associated with people that suffer from major depression. And in this particular study, which was a phase three study, the trial examined the efficacy of this particular digital intervention on sustained attention as a primary outcome measure. It's a fairly intensive treatment plan occurring 5 days a week for 6 weeks. The study was controlled from the standpoint of using another group receiving an intervention that was not targeted at sustained attention, but took the same amount of time. And the findings basically showed that this digital intervention appeared to be significantly better than the comparator for increasing sustained attention in patients with depression, who, by the way, were also at the time partially treated and on antidepressant medication.
It was an interesting conversation, but how would you say this paper links in with the rest of the issue?
Well, so as I mentioned, the issue is about major depression, and we have another paper that looks at another treatment, in this case, a medication treatment for depression. And we also have another paper that looks at ways to better predict who's going to respond to transcranial magnetic stimulation. So it fits in that way. And also, we have a paper that gets at other components of depression, predominantly the anhedonic component, which is a cardinal feature of depression.
Do you want to walk us through any of those?
Sure. Be happy to. So maybe I can talk next about one of the other treatment studies. This is a really interesting study comparing dextromethorphan plus bupropion as a combination treatment to bupropion alone for patients with major depression. Now, you might ask why dextromethorphan. Most people identify dextromethorphan as being a component of cough medicine, but it also turns out that dextromethorphan has effects on some of the systems that we've identified to be potentially important in treating depression, and that is the NMDA receptor, in which this is an NMDA receptor antagonist, as well as a drug that has other multiple effects, including effects on the sigma-1 receptor. So the reason that bupropion was added into this combination was the idea that bupropion would further increase the bioavailability of dextromethorphan to the brain by increasing plasma levels of a metabolite that's active called dextrofam. And bupropion is hypothesized to do this by inhibiting an enzyme that is important in the metabolism of this pathway, and that's the CYP2D6 enzyme. So in this particular study, which is a relatively small study, the investigators had a group of individuals that received dextromethorphan plus bupropion at 210 milligrams and also with 90 milligrams of dextromethorphan, or simply the 210 milligrams of bupropion alone. And findings basically demonstrated that at 2 weeks, the combination treatment separated from and was superior to bupropion alone. This was also seen at 6 weeks. So the authors report this finding and also are interested in more rapid acting antidepressants and make the suggestion that this is acting fairly rapidly at the 2-week time point. There are a number of issues with this study that are worth mentioning. First, the dose of bupropion used is relatively low compared to what we tend to use clinically. So we tend to use 300 milligrams a day clinically, not always, but frequently. So comparing the combination to a relatively low dose of bupropion is a bit of an issue. And then there are also questions about sort of the mechanism of action of how is this really working. And we have a really nice editorial that Dr. Alan Schatzberg has written that accompanies this paper that gets into more depth about some of the issues that I just mentioned.
It's interesting. So far, we've had a digital intervention and a drug intervention, but we also have one that focuses on transcranial magnetic stimulation. What can you tell us about that?
So that's a paper by G and co-authors in patients with treatment-resistant depression. And here, what the investigators do is they, in 38 patients, basically look at the initial response to one session of TMS on brain function by using fMRI. And by so doing, are able to predict the likelihood of response in individuals that are receiving TMS. And they use functional connectivity data that is generated from the fMRI data and then use machine learning techniques to make these predictions. So this is quite interesting because it suggests that the very initial response to TMS from the standpoint of the brain's flexibility and plasticity can be used as a predictor of whether or not a longer course of TMS may be effective in patients that haven't been responsive to other treatments. A very insightful editorial accompanies this paper as well, written by Dr. Fabio Farelli from the University of Pittsburgh.
Next up, we've got a paper from Pan and colleagues looking at a longitudinal study of a large group of adolescents. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so this is a study using brain imaging as well. It's longitudinal, which is important. And it really tries to get at the issue of anhedonia in adolescents. Now, anhedonia in and of itself is really an important symptom of depression. It's a cardinal feature of depression. It's a feature that frequently is used to distinguish, for example, depression from anxiety disorders. And we know a lot about the reward circuitry that underlies anhedonia. In fact, included in this issue is a comprehensive review written by Dr. Diego Pizzagalli from McLean Hospital, getting more into an explanation of the mechanisms that underlie anhedonia. But in this particular study by Pan and colleagues, the findings are interesting because using functional connectivity data from the Imogen data set, the authors are able to predict depressive disorders in 14-year-olds, brain patterns that are related to that in relation to the reward circuitry. So for example, to be more specific, alterations in the connectivity of the reward circuitry, particularly the right ventral striatal region, seems to be altered in individuals at 14 years of age that have depression. And other findings related to the circuit are predictive of anhedonic responses over the long term. So this begins to shed some light into how anhedonia and reward-related circuitry alterations, especially involving the striatum, may be related to cardinal features of depression, especially in the formative years during adolescence, which is a period during which there's an emergence of depressive symptoms in depression and is a critical period from the standpoint of thinking about longer-term treatments.
It's a really interesting issue that looks at depression from a bunch of different angles.
Yes, yes. No, it's particularly exciting. You know, we also have a study related to looking at the amygdala in relation to depressive symptoms. And I'll just say a few words about that. This is a study that takes advantage of an extremely large sample, more than 28,000 individuals as participants in the UK Biobank study. And in a fairly straightforward question, the investigators looked to see whether there was a relation between individual differences in reactivity of the amygdala when individuals are presented with pictures of negative stimuli to depressive symptoms. The reason this is interesting is because the amygdala and alterations in amygdala function have been for a long time associated with depression and anxiety disorders across the board. What's interesting about this paper is that the authors really fail to find a strong relation between depressive symptoms and amygdala reactivity in this sample when the individuals are presented with negative faces, which in and of themselves will activate the amygdala. And this was a somewhat surprising finding, but this finding would suggest the possibility that the amygdala is not so important in relation to depression. However, that interpretation really, I think, is much too broad the study only looks at one parameter of amygdala reactivity. It's a much more complicated story, likely from the standpoint of other stimuli that may activate the amygdala, looking at the amygdala during resting states as well from the standpoint of functional connectivity. And so it's a really interesting study. It gets at one specific aspect of the amygdala, but is not, I think, the final conclusion at all in relation to amygdala involvement in depression. And I should just say that the anhedonia studies that we talked about earlier have to do with reward-related circuitry, which we believe is altered and dampened from the standpoint of its responsivity in patients with depression and underlying the anhedonic symptoms. But anhedonia is certainly only one component of depression. Another component is the negative affect and angst that individuals feel and anxiety that goes with that. And we believe that the negative emotion-related circuitry, in this case, the amygdala, is probably quite involved with that. In a very insightful editorial that's authored by a graduate student and colleagues from the University of Maryland and University of California, Davis, Shannon Grogans is the grad student, and Andrew Fox is from University of California, Davis, and Alex Shackman is from University of Maryland. These authors put this finding into context from the standpoint of how to think about it in relation to the amygdala, its involvement in stress, psychopathology, and more specifically, anxiety and depressive disorders. You know, just as a general comment, the issue comprehensively, as I mentioned, focuses on major depression. This is an area where we obviously have need for improvements in our treatment efficacy, our remission rates, and also the rapidity of responsiveness to our treatments. These papers begin to get at those issues, and I think are a great illustration of how clinical trials and the science underlying negative and positive affect and reward and fear are important from the standpoint of building an understanding of mechanisms that are related to the symptoms that we see in depression, and also hopefully paving the way to create a neuroscientific rationale for developing new treatments.
Dr. Kalin, thanks again for putting this issue into context for us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all for this month's AJP Audio, but there's more podcasts where that came from. Check out this month's Psychiatric Services from Pages to Practice, where hosts Dr. Lisa Dixon and Dr. Josh Bereson speak with Dr. George Pro about the changing demographics of the U.S. and access to mental health care services offered in Spanish. That and much more at psychiatryonline.org/podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual speakers only and do not necessarily represent those of the American Psychiatric Association. The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only and does not offer medical or any other type of professional advice. If you're having a medical emergency, please contact your local emergency response number.